If you're thinking about it, she's talking about it. Join the conversation at 203-333-9422. The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600.
And welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show. So I saw that our next guest, Dr. Jesse Nasta, was mentioned pretty liberally. In other words, he was quoted very extensively in a recent article that was talking about Black history in the context of our current Black Lives Matter movement and the upheaval and all of the Sturm und Drang that is going on, the protests, the response to the protests, some of the anarchy that's going on with respect to like what's happening in Seattle, some of the violence, but also a lot of the positive progress. Mississippi yesterday taking down its symbol of the Confederacy, long overdue, as part of its state flag, and learning about 19th, June 19th, Juneteenth. And I think for a lot of white Americans, and I'll raise my hand, I'm one of them, there's been an awful lot of history that we have been learning in the last few weeks as part of everything that has happened since George Floyd's horrid, horrid death at the hands of police and excessive force. So joining us right now, Dr. Jesse Nasta is a visiting assistant professor of African American Studies at Wesleyan University, but also the executive director of the Middlesex County Historical Society in Middletown, Connecticut. His focus right now, his research is focusing on the Beamans, a leading Black abolitionist family that established one of New England's first free property-owning Black communities before the Civil War, part of Professor Nasta's broader research on slavery, emancipation, and the African-American freedom struggle right here in New England. I think there's a lot we can learn. I open up the phones for you to be part of the conversation at 203-333-9422. You can call me at 203-333-9422. Jesse Nasta, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Hello and good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's a pleasure. So I keep reading that you're a Connecticut native. What part of Connecticut were you born and bred?
I'm actually from Middletown, where I now teach and study.
Okay. And you are obviously very fascinated with the history of Middletown, Connecticut, and the contributions of African Americans that passed through there and stayed there.
Absolutely. In terms of my own research, I feel like Middletown, Connecticut's African-American history is very significant in terms of telling the story of slavery and anti-slavery in Connecticut. At the same time, it raises questions and themes that apply to all of New England and all of the United States, that, you know, especially at the time of the American Revolution, when the nation was founded, slavery was legal and practiced in all colonies in what became the U.S. states. So slavery was really national in the 1700s, not just Southern.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a part of our history that at least my generation didn't learn, right? Because my generation always learned that slavery was the South, abolitionists were the North beat the South, the good guys won, quote unquote, right? And never really did I ever learn, and I grew up in New York, that there was any kind of legalized slavery in New York, which I know was legal until 1827 in New York, and was legal far past that in Connecticut, where they had this hybrid compromise. Jesse Nasta, can you tell us a little bit about this, Professor? What was the history, the legal history of slavery in Connecticut?
Sure. So Connecticut, like New York, like northern states, practiced slavery until the late 1700s. And then in the late 1700s, passed what were called gradual emancipation laws. So essentially, they did not free anyone. They said that if you were born after a certain date, you would be free when you reached 25 or 28 or 30 years. So essentially, it made freedom a generation-long struggle instead of freeing everyone outright. So for example, New York passed its gradual emancipation law in 1799, but the law said that people wouldn't be free universally until 1827, a full 28 years later. So an African-American born in 1799 could spend the first 28 years of their life still enslaved under this law.
What was the thinking, you know, as you're a historian, what was the thinking at that time in terms of doing it that way? Why did they do it that way?
I'd say there were two major reasons. One was economic, the idea that it was considered radical to free African-Americans outright because the law defined them as property and very valuable property. So one of the major concerns of lawmakers was, well, we want to gradually end slavery in the North, but we don't want to, you know, violate the, quote, property rights of enslavers, right? So there was a very economic, treating human beings as property, and also a racist cultural reason. The idea that despite the fact that African Americans had fought in the American Revolution and had been, you know, fighting for freedom with, you know, and resisting slavery for generations, there is the idea that African Americans were not, you know, ready for freedom, which is, we know now, is ludicrous, but a lot of them thought they had to have a 30-year teaching process for freedom, which African Americans themselves absolutely denied at the time.
In other words, they weren't ready, that there was a sort of a paternalistic, patronizing view that
right.
these people aren't ready for this all at once kind of thing. Like children,
yeah.
they have to be guided along towards it. I see. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So, yeah, very paternalistic and racist at the same time, yes.
Sure, sure. And so tell me about the Beemans. Who are they?
So the Beemans were one of Connecticut's, and really one of New England's, leading black abolitionist families. The first generation that we know of in Connecticut, his name was Caesar, and he lived in Colchester, Connecticut, not too far from Middletown. He had spent the first 30 years or so of his life in slavery, but then he signed up to gain freedom. He signed up and fought in the American Revolutionary War for American independence and was freed as a result. And the story goes that he took the last name Beeman because he said he wanted to, quote, be a man, to be his own free man, which is quite a fascinating story, and also shows a lot of his mentality, you know, the idea that he didn't need to be trained for freedom, he didn't need to be prepared for freedom, he was already a man and he was already equal to other human beings, right? So he was the first generation, and then by the next generation, his son, Jehiel Beeman, was the pastor in Middletown of one of the first free black churches in Connecticut, beginning in 1830. So, and they in turn, Jehiel Beeman and his wife, Nancy Beeman, founded one of the first black women's abolitionist societies in the North for black women. Jehiel Beeman helped found one of the first abolitionist societies in Connecticut. So really the Beemans and then their children in turn were leaders of the abolitionist movement before and during the Civil War. So really you have three generations of activists and fighters for freedom right here in Connecticut in the Beeman family.
How many free blacks were there in Connecticut in the early 1800s or leading up to the Civil War?
Sure, there were several thousand. So African Americans were never more than about 3% of Connecticut's population. That having been said, although they were only several thousand, about 3% of the population, they built a really important network of free black churches, free black anti-slavery societies, free black communities like the Beeman's community in Middletown and elsewhere throughout the state, and really helped lead to the Civil War and the ultimate abolition of slavery in the South. So politically and culturally, they were immensely important despite their small numbers.
We're chatting with Professor Jesse Nasta, who is a visiting professor of African American Studies at Wesleyan University and the executive director of the Middlesex County Historical Society here in Middletown, Connecticut. So may I call you Jesse? Is that okay? May I call
Please.
You
Please.
Okay, thank you. So Jesse, so the Beemans, I'm curious to know, how did the Beemans make a living within this area? Were they farmers, making a living on their own land and then like other farmers selling their crop at the end of the season for whatever it would go for? Or did they employ other people or work for other people? How'd they make a living?
Right. So Jehiel Beeman, the pastor in Middletown, he and his son actually were shoemakers. They had their own shoemaking shop. So among the free black population in New England, you did have a subset who were artisans, shoemakers, barbers. In the 1800s, African Americans were really predominated in the barbering trade, and were later supplanted by white immigrants for the most part. But in the 1800s, barbering, for example, was one of the major ways for free black men in particular to make a living. Another really important part, the Beemans themselves were not involved, but a lot of free African Americans worked on ships in the whaling industry, the coasting trade, so delivering goods from New England down to New York and even down to the South. And that's one reason why free black communities really clustered along the Long Island Sound and the Connecticut River, because the river and the Long Island Sound and the Atlantic Ocean were so important to their livelihoods in freedom.
You know, it was it's hard to imagine to walk back into that world here, but were abolitionists in Connecticut the majority of thought, or were there a lot of people in Connecticut among white people who were rooting South to win on the issue of slavery? What was it like here?
The short answer is that abolitionists were not the majority in Connecticut. Initially in the 1830s and 1840s, the earlier period of abolitionism in Connecticut, you had abolitionists, white and black, being attacked for holding anti-slavery meetings in Connecticut. They would have, stones thrown at them, they'd be punched. So there was really a lot of anti-abolitionism in Connecticut. And part of it was because of the racist ideas that came out of Connecticut slavery. And also there were huge economic ties. So many in early industrialists in New England and New York made their living, for example, from cotton grown by enslaved people in the South. So a lot of Northerners had an economic stake in Southern slavery right after the Civil War.
So, and yet Connecticut was the North, definitely part of the Union. Obviously, devoted a lot of its manpower to fighting the Civil War. And the Civil War ultimately became about slavery. When or how or if did the majority population in Connecticut start to shift on that issue?
That's a great question. So earlier, like the 1830s and 1840s, abolitionists were not popular. By the 1850s and right up to when the Civil War began in 1861, the majority of whites in Connecticut gradually became anti-slavery and anti-Southern, because slaveholders in the South kept trying to expand westward into places like Kansas and Nebraska, and were getting more and more political and economic power in Congress. So a lot of white Northerners started to say, you know what, we don't want to be controlled by the interests of plantation owners or plantation-based economy. And also a lot of white Northerners had this fear that they would have to, quote, compete with enslaved labor. So, like, if New Englanders wanted to go west to Illinois, for example, Kansas, they didn't want to compete with enslaved labor. So eventually, for largely political and economic reasons, not necessarily moral reasons, the majority of Connecticut became pro-Union and anti-Southern by the time of the Civil War. I think what you were saying, how we learned that, the North were the good ones and the South were bad, I think a lot of that is kind of a memory frozen from immediately before the Civil War. You know what I mean? By the time the Civil War broke out in 1861, there were strongly divided North versus South. But we forget all the decades and decades that came before that and the centuries before that.
Well, history is rarely told in shades of gray and nuance, right, Professor? I mean, particularly when you're in seventh and eighth grade, you're lucky if you can remember a headline. We're chatting with Dr. Jesse Nasta, who is a visiting assistant professor of African American Studies at Wesleyan University. And he's the executive director of the Middlesex County Historical Society in Middletown, Connecticut, which is, just a particularly interesting piece and part of Connecticut's history vis-a-vis all of these property-owning black communities that grew up free people right after we were ending slavery here. And what I want to know is, what happened to the Beamans? Did they end up assimilating with white families? Did they keep their black cultural identity for many generations? What happened to the Beamans?
They always kept their black cultural identity. After the Civil War, a lot of them became leaders in party politics. Once African Americans in Connecticut could vote, became leaders in black churches and black fraternal and organizations. So absolutely. I'm still tracing their present day descendants, but I know some went to Chicago, for example, for greater opportunity. So they never, lost their African American identity over the centuries.
And in terms of this sort of coalition of free black churches that had their own economic stature, did that stay through the 150 years? What happened to those communities and those institutions?
And that's a great question. That's one thing that's so important, is that the communities, the African American communities of two centuries ago, their institutions are still around and thriving. So, for example, Jehiel Beeman was the pastor of the AME Zion Church in Middletown, they'll be celebrating their 200th anniversary in 2 years. So, you know, they're called the Cross Street AME Zion Church in Middletown. When people see that church building, they might not realize that that congregation has a 198-year history behind it. Jehiel Beeman's son, Amos Beeman, became the pastor of the Dixwell Avenue Congregational Church in New Haven. That was the first black church in Connecticut. They're celebrating their 200th anniversary this year. So really, the work they did and the institutions they created to really make freedom real and to, you know, assert their freedom and their equality are still going strong right here in Connecticut 2 centuries later.
And are those churches still predominantly black congregations?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
They are.
I'm often the only white person there, which, you know, is understandable and as it should be, right? I mean, these were institutions created by and for black people in an extremely racist society. So I think it's only fitting that they are still, you know, predominantly by and for the black community.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to grapple with that whole conversation, Jesse Nasta, as we think about, well, as we just... as everything sort of gets turned on its head a little bit about alliances, about opening up freedom and opportunity, about giving preferences to people on the basis of their race in order to redress or remedy prior injustices, but then still encouraging people who want to be together on the basis of their common history or whatever clannish reason they want to be together to allow them to be together. I mean, it's all... it's in a mix, isn't it? Don't you think?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we could all agree that we should have equal economic opportunity. We should have equal, you know, political opportunity, be treated with equality, and yet be allowed to respect and love our differences, right? And our own personal histories. It's pretty simple, but it oftentimes, you know, plays out in really complex ways in the political sphere.
So, as a white person, is there a particular reason why you've chosen to make African American studies your concentrated area of intellectual pursuit?
Well, again, growing up, you know, right there in Middletown, I grew up literally a block from the Beeman's pre-Civil War neighborhood. And, you know, it was really something that I and everybody I knew had, you know, not, had forgotten or never learned about. So I kind of felt like it was my responsibility as a historian to tell the stories of the most forgotten, the most marginalized people right in my own community. And I also feel like this story of slavery and anti-slavery is also a world created by white people, right? You know, so I feel like white people are as responsible for grappling with this history as anyone else. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't just be someone else's responsibility or a special interest or a special project.
Yeah, I agree with that. And particularly if we're going to move forward and try and join hands and move to a different society with more justice, we have to see things from another person's point of view. And that, to me, begins with learning lessons of history that I didn't know. So I'm really grateful for your contributions to the newspaper, coming on the show today. And I'll keep reading what it is that you write and talk about because, you know, I like to be learning all the time. And I think that the more that we learn, the more we sort of settle down, if you know what I mean. We're less inflamed, we're less inflammatory in our responses because we know more. And
right. And
that's the secret, I think. We just have to know, to just keep learning and learning, and then just walk in somebody else's shoes for a few minutes and see it from someone else's point of view.
Absolutely. And if I may speak very quickly about some resources, for example,
sure.
It's called the Connecticut Freedom Trail. That project marks over 100 African-American history sites throughout the state. So, for example, someone could go on the website of the Connecticut Freedom Trail, I'm a member of their committee, and see what sites are there in Fairfield, what sites are there in Bridgeport to learn more. The Colored Convention Movement was a movement by free African-Americans to basically form their own political meetings, essentially almost like an African-American Congress at a time when African-Americans in New England were disenfranchised. You could Google that and learn about the colored conventions, as they were called at the time in New England. So there are a lot of resources out there online and in person.
Thank you very much, Professor Jesse Nasta, for joining us on the Lisa Wexler Show today. Do come back and do, you know, keep me on your mailing list as part of interesting things you learn along the way. I thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
the pleasure. Jesse Nest on the Lisa Wexler Show. We'll be right back.